said, "I have never bounced a check." Number three, Representative Tim Penny, a Democrat from Minnesota, blamed his overdrafts on his office manager. Number four, Representative Adolphus Towns, another Democrat from New York, attributed many of his 403 overdrafts to embezzlement by a former employee. And number five, former Representative Newt Gingrich, a Republican from Georgia and House Republican whip, dismissed his overdrafts as no big deal. Well, we think it is a big deal because elected officials should serve as role models for more responsible behavior, both before and after the fact. Not doing so represents a singular lack of courage. For people languishing in the victim cycle and unable to come to grips with the reality of their situations, it takes a lot of courage to, one, recognize when they fall below the line. Two, realize that remaining below the line not only ignores the real problem, but leads to increasingly poor results. And three, acknowledge and accept reality as the first step toward taking accountability. Acknowledging below-the-line behavior and facing up to the reality of your situation does take courage. Failure to muster that courage results in an unwillingness to pay the price for greater accountability and results. In most troublesome situations, people do know, in the back of their minds, that acknowledging reality means they'll have to change something that many of us fear and even resist. That change generally begins with choosing to see a situation in a different way, and viewing the situation differently often means admitting that you did something wrong, that you yourself could have done more and didn't. Deciding you can't do anything to remedy the situation, you may as well move on. Why solve a problem when you can run away from it? For those who have been truly victimized, at the hands of a criminal, for example, it may mean deciding that you can't allow that particular event to hold you back throughout your life. After all, success on the heels of real victimization is the best revenge you can exact on the situation. Doing something differently about your situation often requires doing things you dislike doing, such as taking a risk you've been avoiding or confronting an issue or person you've been ducking. At Hartmarks Corporation, the Chicago-based maker of men's suits, the board of directors failed to confront the inability of the company's chief executive officer, Harvey Weinberg, to halt a string of losses that eventually totaled $320 million. Only then did the board force Weinberg to resign. According to the Wall Street Journal, the board didn't act sooner because it didn't want to be seen as pulling the plug too early. Unfortunately, the wait-and-see attitude significantly contributed to the company's stock value plummeting from $600 million to $200 million. Embracing such realities can prove difficult because doing so involves shedding the protective cocoon of a victim story. It seems so much safer to remain below the line, but in reality, the cocoon offers only an illusion of safety. Eventually, the time will come to pay the piper for your inaction. When you give yourself permission to do nothing about your situation, when you don't act, don't learn, don't acknowledge your responsibility, don't admit having done wrong, don't face the facts, don't give up the sympathy that a victim's story attracts, and don't look for what else you can do to achieve results or to improve your life, your behavior gets you nowhere. To get something better and to solve your problems, you must abandon the illusion of safety below the line and take the risks involved in rising above the line. When you encounter a difficult situation, ask yourself whether you want to remain mired in the difficulty or attempt some sort of breakthrough to extract yourself from it. Even the most habitual victim would rather be leading a better life, but achieving a breakthrough usually requires a break with past actions and attitudes. That means that any person feeling victimized must replace his or her victim story with a willingness to see things as they really are and not as they appear from the tenuous safety of a below-the-line attitude. The consequences of not seeing it. When Christopher J. Steffen resigned as chief financial officer at Eastman Kodak after less than 3 months on the job, his exit exposed the growing vulnerability of boards of directors who must assess the reality of their company's needs in a timely fashion. According to the Wall Street Journal, management experts say boards of directors everywhere are under greater pressure nowadays to fill top jobs quickly. Directors sometimes fail to gauge whether a new executive, especially below the chief executive officer's level, will mesh with existing senior management. According to the article in Eastman Kodak's case, Stephan's resignation knocked $1.7 billion off market value of the company's stock. Not seeing reality, especially at the board level, can deliver devastating and sometimes lightning-swift consequences. We recently worked with a client who, because of the sensitive nature of the story and our desire to protect the privacy of the individuals involved, must remain disguised. It is a true story, however, and it exposes the inexorable consequences of not seeing reality. Tim Langley, president and CEO of CET, a $400 million insurance company, had recently hired Jed Simon as his new vice president of underwriting to resolve a sales volume shortfall in the near term and to build a world-class underwriting organization in the long term. Langley believed he had hired the perfect man, and after the first year together, Langley awarded Simon a rave review for his work and even implied that his protege would someday succeed him as CEO of the company. Soon after joining CET, Simon had introduced an organizational effectiveness program that created greater openness and productivity throughout the company's underwriting operations and quickly ended the sales shortfall. In addition, Simon drafted a new policy manual, hired new staff, and beefed up the organization's capabilities to meet anticipated future demand. Since his actions enabled the company to surpass all its annual goals, Langley took to calling Simon the best underwriting vice president in the business. Then, as the year ended and the new year began, Langley shifted CET's emphasis from increased sales to better customer service. Simon's reputation plummeted almost overnight. In stark contrast to last year's review, his next one nailed him to the wall. From Langley's perspective, Simon had been ignoring vital feedback from the sales force about CET's dismal customer service. According to the sales force, poor service quality made it impossible for them to sustain and increase sales. When we dug into the situation, we discovered that Simon responded to this feedback from deep within the victim cycle. Here's how he described his feelings to us. "How can I get a review like this? I have never received such a horrible review. What do these salespeople know anyway? They can't even make accurate sales forecasts for one quarter, the sandbaggers. They want a sure thing in terms of their sales quotas, and they never stretch for higher goals. They haven't even looked at the monthly graphs that clearly show customer complaints down and sales up. Furthermore, we have rolled out so many new products prematurely that we have ended up doing the job of the development people along with our own. You know, I really think Langley's got an ego problem and feels threatened by me. Last year, he told me and many others that he thought I was the best underwriting vice president in the industry. He even told me that I would succeed him someday. Now he's telling me I'm doing a rotten job. I don't think he knows what he wants. He changes his priorities every time I turn around. He's the one who's got a problem, not me." While there may have been some truth to Simon's perceptions, he was clearly wallowing below the line by refusing to acknowledge the reality of his circumstances. Through a series of rationalizations, he convinced himself that the alleged service quality problem shouldn't fall in his lap. Worse, he considers his current course of action productive, appropriate, and designed to yield superior results, when in fact, it won't. Before Jed Simon could see it, he needed to, 1, acknowledge his own below-the-line behavior, 2, recognize the reality and not necessarily the accuracy of his boss's perception that he has failed in the area of service quality, and 3, realize that as long as he stays below the line, he will remain ineffective. Simon's inability and or unwillingness to acknowledge reality has created a growing chasm between himself and his boss, and no matter how unjust it may seem to him, when it comes to a showdown, he'll lose. Langley will win. Simon isn't the only leader to fail to see reality and subsequently face the consequences. Think back to IBM's memorable decline over the last decade. As recorded in Time magazine, for years, IBM stubbornly attempted to ignore the trend away from big mainframes. Instead of adapting, it tried to protect its base. But with sales slowing and price pressure mounting, IBM has finally faced up to the trend. Akers signaled IBM's intention to shift away from its mainframe business, which is down 10% this year. This situation did not occur overnight, and a number of IBM competitors had already paid the price for not mustering the courage to see it coming. Wang Laboratories filed for bankruptcy. Unisys, created by the merger of Burroughs and Sperry, suffered $2.5 billion in losses, and Digital Equipment almost sank under similarly huge losses, which resulted in the ouster of Digital's founder and president, Kenneth Olson. Clearly, the handwriting was on the wall. The old non-mainframe strategies no longer worked. IBM, however, ignored the signals, even when upstart Apple computers surpassed IBM as the leading PC maker and tacked up a stellar performance, partly due to a tiny frame computer, the laptop PowerBook. Aggressive price cutting in the industry sparked great demand, which Apple and IBM-compatible Compaq rushed to fill. IBM also failed to anticipate the workstation revolution and sat by as Sun Microsystems and Hewlett-Packard took the lead in that market. As the Time article concluded, although it developed superb technology years ago, the company sat on it out of fear that it would cannibalize IBM's bread-and-butter mainframe business. Failing to see the reality of its situation, IBM lost both the value of its bread-and-butter business and the chance to position itself advantageously for the future. When did the downfall occur? In an earlier story, Fortune magazine pinpointed the time precisely. To understand fully just what a disaster IBM has been and just how blind its own management was to the depth of its problems, step back to a moment in late 1986. IBM was more than a year past a boom period and struggling. Revenue growth was miserable, earnings growth was non-existent, and IBM stock, then $125 a share, had lost nearly $24 billion in market value from a peak of $99 billion just 7 months earlier. In an interview with Fortune, Chairman John F. Akers nonetheless exhibited gritty confidence. 4 or 5 years from now, he asserted, people will look back and see that the company's performance has been superlative. Almost 5 years later, reality proved Akers dead wrong. IBM stock continued to fall, losing another $18 billion in market value. Revenue grew at less than half the industry average for the period, and IBM's worldwide market share fell from 30 to 21%, a whopping $3 billion in sales for each percentage point. When asked by Fortune what went wrong and why his prediction of superlative performance didn't pan out, Akers replied, "I don't think anything went wrong." Fortune reporters responded, "Then why, one might reasonably ask, did he tell his managers in May 1991 that IBM was in crisis, a characterization made in private and quickly leaked to the press? And if IBM stock has lost $42 billion in value since 1986, just how far would it have fallen if something really had gone wrong?" Akers later claimed he only meant to emphasize that Big Blue's industry is so volatile that no company can anticipate all the unexpected changes that sweep through it. To his credit, however, he admitted that IBM could not blame any outside force for its stupendous loss of market share. In 1994, IBM's woes grew even worse than in 1991 and 1992, and the company's new chief executive officer, Louis Gerstner, must have felt much like the Wizard of Oz, from whom everyone expected an improbable miracle. When IBM's new leader came aboard, he immediately began to help the company see the reality of its situation and to act on it. Now, almost 10 years later, almost everyone acknowledges the problem. In his first meeting at IBM, as described in his book, Who Says Elephants Can't Dance, Louis V. Gerstner, Jr. writes, "It is not helpful to feel sorry for ourselves. I'm sure our employees don't need any rah-rah speeches. We need leadership and a sense of direction and momentum, not just doom around here. I want can-do people looking for short-term victories and long-term excitement. I told them there was no time to focus on who created our problems. I had no interest in that. We have little time to spend on problem definition. We must focus our efforts on solutions and actions." Not wasting any time, he then proposed the following 5 90-day priorities. 1. Stop hemorrhaging cash. We were precariously close to running out of money. 2. Make sure we would be profitable in 1994 to send a message to the world and to the IBM workforce that we had stabilized the company. 3. develop and implement a key customer strategy for 1993 and 1994, one that would convince customers that we were back serving their interests, not just pushing iron mainframes down their throat to ease our short-term financial pressures. 4. Finish right-sizing by the beginning of the third quarter. And 5. Develop an intermediate-term business strategy. The very basis of IBM's historic turnaround was established in this first meeting lasting all of 45 minutes. It isn't always easy to see reality, but you must see it if you expect people to move above the line and take ownership for their results. With that in mind, let's now look at how you can assess and develop your own ability to acknowledge reality and thereby avoid the unpleasant and inevitable consequences of failing to see it. See it, self-assessment. Picture in your mind's eye something we see all too often, the sales vice president of a mid-sized computer manufacturer telling his colleague, the marketing vice president, that the company's sales are weak because its products don't meet customer needs, but the marketing vice president dismissing the argument. In such a situation, the sales vice president perceives that the marketing vice president never listens to his group's input, while the marketing vice president thinks that the sales vice president never appreciates the sales group's input. Both feel victimized by the other, and both remain stuck below the line, unwilling to acknowledge reality. Unless these two executives can see reality, they will squander their time and energy blaming each other, fostering confusion, promoting organizational discord, and creating an environment in which their people wait and see if their leaders will work things out. So how do these vice presidents begin recognizing their below-the-line attitudes and behavior? The first step requires careful and honest self-assessment. To facilitate your own self-assessment, we have developed the See It self-assessment, which will give you a general idea of your ability to recognize a below-the-line posture. Take a few minutes to evaluate your ability to see it in the context of your work, home, team, club, community, church, or association, answering each question as honestly as you can. After you have completed the See It self-assessment, total up your score. The table provides some guidelines for evaluating your ability to recognize when you're stuck below the line. Once you have assessed yourself, don't get discouraged if you discover that you need help seeing it. You can get a lot of help if you ask others familiar with your situation to give you perfectly candid feedback. How feedback improves your ability to see it. You can gain great insight from frequent, regular, and ongoing feedback from other people. Although it can cause a great deal of pain and embarrassment at times, honest input helps create the accurate picture of reality that lies at the core of accountability. Since no one individual can mandate a perfectly accurate description of reality, you must draw from as many other people's perceptions to imbue your reality with the deepest possible understanding of its many hues and shades. In our experience, accountable people constantly seek feedback from a wide range of associates, be they friends, family, business partners, consultants, or other advisors. Remember, other people's perceptions of reality, whether you agree with them or not, always add important nuances to your own perception. The more perspectives you obtain, the more easily you can recognize when you're stuck below the line. Move above the line, and then encourage others to do likewise. To better grasp the importance of seeking and giving feedback, picture in your mind a common situation we encountered with one of our clients, Betty Bingham, a corporate staff human resources vice president of a large corporation, who has been temporarily reassigned to clean up a division's human resources policies and practices. The people in the division naturally view her as an intruder, and she assumes after a few weeks that all the bad press she's getting automatically comes with such bad guy assignments. Several months later, when she thinks it's time to return to her corporate staff assignment, she learns that headquarters doesn't want her back. Worse, she receives no salary increase. Devastated by this turn of events, Betty feels victimized and confused because she had received no direct feedback about her performance from headquarters or from the division president to whom she has been temporarily reporting. Instead of feeling sorry for herself, however, she begins seeking direct feedback from the people she's been working with over the last 9 months. As she seeks and receives this input, she discovers that her cleanup methods have caused deep resentments and frustrations. For example, One vice president confided in her that he thought she did not respect others' points of view, that she did not acknowledge the previous accomplishments of the organization or her staff, and that she tended to take credit due others. This sort of feedback helped Betty gain an awareness of how she had caused much of the bad press herself, which made it difficult for her to get the results she needed now. Armed with honest feedback, she set out to turn around the negative perceptions and win back the confidence of people in both the division and at headquarters. To her delight, more and more people began to confide in her, and she soon built a reputation as a credible and useful executive. Before she got the feedback, she felt victimized, powerless, and unable to change things. She was truly unaware and unbelieving with respect to how others viewed her. Had she remained trapped in that resentment, she would undoubtedly have sought employment elsewhere. After the feedback, however, she could see it more clearly and consequently feel more empowered to do something about her predicament. In short, she had moved herself above the line. If you find yourself continually surprised by your performance appraisals, we suggest that you do what Betty did and seek more feedback about your performance, not just from your superiors, but from others whom you respect and trust. It's easy to go home and rant against your superiors over what you perceive as unjust treatment. It's hard to ask your family to help you understand why you've gotten the review you did. But you must do it right. Over the years, we have observed both right and wrong ways to seek feedback. If you don't do it right, you may only hear what people think you want to hear. To gain the most honest feedback, try these tips. 1. Ask for feedback in the right environment, a comfortable, quiet place free from interruptions and distractions. 2. Tell the person from whom you're seeking feedback that you want completely honest input about a particular situation or concern. Emphasize your sincerity and explain your motivation. 3. Remember, the feedback you're requesting represents an important point of view, so don't get defensive, even if you strongly disagree with something the person says. 4. Listen carefully and ask for elaboration, but be sure not to invalidate feedback offhandedly with which you disagree. And 5. Make sure you express your appreciation for your advisor's time and help. Once you have more fully examined your own above and below the line behavior, consider the substantial benefits that automatically flow to someone who has mustered the courage to face reality. The benefits of seeing it. As we indicated at the beginning of this chapter, even if you consider yourself a highly accountable person, you can still get stuck in the victim cycle when facing a particular challenge, as we ourselves did not long ago with an important client. To protect our client's privacy, we'll refer to the organization as DALCAP. We always strive for superior customer service with our clients, but something in our consulting engagement with DALCAP over a 6-month period caused certain key executives there to perceive us as below the line in terms of customer service. Had we somehow failed to practice what we preach? While we saw them as our most demanding client, we had also felt that we had risen to the occasion time and time again. While we knew that our client harbored certain concerns, we pretended not to know they resented what they saw as inaccessibility. Each time a DALCAP executive cited an example of our inaccessibility, we were stunned. How could she say that after all the extraordinary things we had accomplished for the firm? We rationalized it as all false expectations on their part by convincing ourselves that no matter what we did, we could never make this client happy. Eventually, however, after a lot of discussion, we realized that in order to maintain a successful relationship with DALCAP, we had to acknowledge that we were falling short of their expectations. We knew that we must get above the line and demonstrate the see-it attitude we emphasize so much in our consulting work. As a first step, we wrote the following memo to DALCAP's executive staff. To DALCAP executive staff members, from Partners in Leadership, LLC. Subject, Customer Orientation. We reviewed our recent proposal to DALCAP with Barbara Kowal this morning, and we're pleased to hear that we will probably go forward with the project. We appreciate your confidence in our ability to continue to assist DALCAP. Barbara very graciously shared with us some constructive feedback about our work during one of your recent executive staff meetings. Some people honestly feel Partners in Leadership has not been as accessible as it should be. This deeply concerns us because it seems to indicate that some at DALCAP question our commitment to customer service. we want you to know that we will do everything we can to prove our commitment. Your feedback will help us to grow, and that will help us help you. We promise this. Partners in Leadership will be accessible. We understand that perceptions do not change overnight, but we have already begun to work on establishing this new perception. Specifically, 1. Throughout our engagement, we will call Barbara Kowal weekly to review progress and to determine whether we should meet with any of you or any of the trained facilitators. 2. While our travel and our work facilitating off-site sessions may prevent us from getting back to you right away, we will personally respond to your voicemail messages no later than the evening of the day on which you call. And 3. If you need to reach us for an immediate response, please call our office number, area code 909-694-5596. Emphasize that you have an urgent message and need to reach us right away. We will make sure our people remain alert for all such calls and that they relay them to us immediately. We will get back to you within 4 hours. If at any time you doubt our accessibility, tell us so at once. We need your continued feedback to foster our own accountability for results. We look forward to our ongoing relationship and the growth of both our organizations. Sincerely, Partners in Leadership. While this response may not appear extraordinary, it did communicate to our client that we heard their feedback, acknowledged their concern, and would respond to their needs. Less than 1 month after receiving the memo, the president of DALCAP signed a new long-term agreement with us, larger than our two previous ones with the company. It would have been much easier for us to continue denying or rationalizing DALCAP's perception of our inaccessibility, but doing so would have robbed us of the substantial benefits we gain from such a valuable client. By acknowledging the reality, we ran the risk of appearing wrong, but until we decided to do something about our client's perception, we would never have climbed above the line and changed their perceptions. Preparing for the next step above the line. Oz's lion symbolizes the first dimension of accountability, mustering the courage to see reality. However, Dorothy would need to understand all 4 dimensions of accountability before she would fully understand that only she could rise above her circumstances and return to Kansas. Not surprisingly, along her yellow brick road journey, she learned to love and cherish her companions for each of their unique qualities. In the end, she was able to combine what she had learned from and with her companions to escape feelings of powerlessness and rise above the line to get the results she wanted. In the next chapter, you will see how the Tin Woodsman symbolizes the heart to own it, and in the process, you'll learn how to do that yourself. Keep in mind that to get the results you want at the end of your own journey, you'll need what all the Oz companions gained on theirs. Chapter 5, The Tin Woodsman, Finding the Heart to Own It. "I might have stood there always if you had not come along," he said. "So you have certainly saved my life. How did you happen to be here?" "We are on our way to the Emerald City to see the Great Oz," she answered, "and we stopped at your cottage to pass the night." "Why do you wish to see Oz?" he asked. "I want him to send me back to Kansas, and the Scarecrow wants him to put a few brains into his head," she replied. The Tin Woodsman appeared to think deeply for a moment. Then he said, "Do you suppose Oz could give me a heart?" "Why, I guess so," Dorothy answered. The Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum. Everything seemed out of control. As hard as he tried, Dave Schlotterbeck, CEO of Alaris Medical Systems, just could not get the organization to perform. Alaris Medical Systems, a company with $500 million in revenues and 2,900 employees worldwide, had resulted from the merger of two medical device companies, IVAC and IMED. While this combination should have produced strength and great potential, a huge debt load and underperformance stalled all efforts at realizing that potential. Of particular concern was the disposable products division. Product quality had leveled off at 88%, i.e., only 88% of all products met the company's quality threshold for shipment. Successful deliveries, those completed within 24 hours after receipt of the order, had leveled off at 80%. They had a backlog of 9,000 instruments, with 5,000 spare parts on order. Overall, Alaris as a whole had missed both top and bottom line performance numbers for 3 years running. Nothing Dave did made any difference. As he described his frustration to us, he said, "These were problems that I was personally giving a lot of attention to, in fact, higher levels of attention than I had given to anything in the company. But regardless of the approach I took personally, I really saw no improvement." Using the Oz principle to help every group in the company focus on ownership and accountability, everyone began to mobilize, especially the disposable products division. Over a 2-year period, product quality dramatically increased to 97% and 24-hour delivery success climbed to 99.8%. Every department began turning in similarly improved results. With the organization hitting and, in many cases, exceeding their monthly numbers for the first time since the merger, Wall Street rewarded this impressive turnaround with an equally impressive increase in stock price, a whopping 900%. Capturing this success, Money Magazine listed Alaris as the top-performing stock of 2003 for the last 12 months in the whole country. The results were spectacular, and all this was done while simultaneously cutting inventories in half. Dave Schlotterbeck's assessment of the change in the level of ownership, accountability, and performance was sweet and simple. People in the organization owned their circumstances, established their own targets, and made the improvements, and that's without me paying any attention to it. This is simply the result of their being more accountable, going at this in a very teamwork-oriented fashion, and giving each other a lot of feedback on what we needed to change. The breakthrough at Alaris was the result of focused effort at every level of the organization. People recognized the problem and how they could personally change it. They began to articulate the issues, problems, frustrations, and disappointments, all because they had developed a clear and consistent sense of ownership. No matter what your current circumstances, once you came to see it, you must take the next step to own it. Only by accepting full ownership of all the past and present behavior that keeps you mired in your current circumstances can you hope to improve your future situation. Taking the second step above the line. We'll never forget a speaking engagement at a client's national sales conference in Hawaii, where we witnessed a curious example of what happens when people do not feel a sense of ownership. As we toured the island during the scheduled recreational breaks in the conference, we saw people happily driving cars over the rough lava beds. The vehicles were taking a real beating. 10 to 1, those are the sales reps, we joked. There's no way those people own those cars. Later, during our session, we launched the discussion of owning it by humorously suggesting that self-guided tours through Hawaiian lava beds by rental car might exemplify what we mean by a no-ownership attitude. The embarrassed laughter loosened things up and helped us drive home a crucial point. Ownership of your circumstances isn't circumstantial. All too often, people view unhappy circumstances as accidents of chance. Yet when they find themselves in more pleasant circumstances, they automatically take credit for a job well done. Ownership should not depend on the quality of your circumstance. If you selectively assume accountability for some circumstances, yet conveniently reject it for others, you cannot stay on the steps to accountability. Such occasional accountability not only prevents people from fully owning their contribution to all their circumstances, it also keeps them stuck, mired in the victim cycle, as the following Disguise to Protect the Guilty story aptly illustrates. Brian Porter and Andy Dowling were driving to work together one morning when the radio announcer reported the mugging of a 25-year-old man who now lay in a coma at the local hospital. "Do you ever think that could happen to you?" asked Andy. Brian thought for a moment, then said, "It did happen to me." "You're kidding." "Well, not the way you might think, but I was definitely mugged." "Tell me about it." As Brian told it, during his final year in the MBA program at Northwestern University, he had been interviewing with prospective employers and had almost decided to accept what appeared to be an imminent offer from Citicorp in its international division. Given the fact that it was early May and many of Brian's classmates had already accepted offers, Brian was feeling a little anxious. To his surprise, Brian received a telephone call from the owners of a $15 million a year Southern California-based pool supply distributor where he had worked the previous summer. Sam and Dave, the two founding partners of Sunshine Pool Products, had grown up in Southern California and were close friends with Brian's older brother, a physician practicing in Anaheim. Now, on the telephone, the two men urged Brian to fly to Orange County to talk over a great opportunity. Although Brian told them he intended to accept an offer from Citicorp should it materialize, the partners insisted Brian come anyway. "Bring your wife, Christy, all expenses paid. Just keep an open mind," they urged. Flattered by this show of interest, Brian decided it wouldn't hurt to listen. A few days later, Brian and Christy were met at the LAX terminal by the two partners, who drove the group to a beautiful house in Palos Verdes. If the Mercedes-Benz 500 SL hadn't been enough to impress Brian and Christy, the house certainly was, a rambling Spanish-style ranch home nestled among lush gardens and overlooking the Pacific Ocean. To top it off, the two partners' wives welcomed their guests to a festive table set with antique china and stunning silver. After a wonderful dinner, Brian joined Sam and Dave for a walk along the moonlit ocean cliff, during which he listened to a powerful sales pitch for why he should join Sunshine Pool Products as Vice President of Marketing and Sales. The starting salary and luxurious benefits, including immediate stock options and any car of his choice, made his head swim. Equally alluring was the fact that, fresh out of grad school, Brian would oversee 30 people. Sam concluded the pitch by putting his arm around Brian's shoulder and saying, "Brian, we have a vision of the three of us building a great company together that will make us all wealthy. You have the skills we need to pull it off. It's the opportunity of a lifetime." The next day, Brian and Christy flew back to Chicago wondering how they could turn down such an offer. Brian especially relished the looks on his classmates' faces when they heard about the salary. Suddenly, Citicorp seemed like a pale prospect by comparison. Later that same day, Brian called Sam to accept the job. On July 1, Brian went to work as the Sunshine Pool Products Vice President of Marketing and Sales. After his first 3 months, he felt things were rolling along beautifully. His summer with the firm had prepared him so well for the job that he eased smoothly into his new responsibilities. With his people beating their sales targets, he knew he had made the right career choice. He and Christy were even planning to make an offer on a new home so they could move out of his brother's house where they had been staying since moving to Southern California. Then, on October 8, lightning struck. When he came to work that day, Brian heard a rumor that the company had been sold. Shocked, Brian confronted Sam and Dave, but they simply said, "That's business, kid. You never know what's going to happen next." They went on to assure Brian that his job was secure, hinting that they just might be able to offer him another opportunity of a lifetime in the near future. Brian felt betrayed. What had happened to the vision of the three of them building a great organization? His anger soon gave way to resignation, however, and he decided to hang on and make the situation work. Over the next few months, Brian watched forlornly as sales took a nosedive. Unaccountably, some of Brian's best salespeople were just not performing. After several weeks of sagging orders, he confronted the two people who seemed to have fallen off the most. As the three sat in Brian's office, Don, the more open of the two salesmen, admitted, "Brian, we have to be honest. The new president of the combined companies doesn't have much confidence in you. He approached us both a couple of months ago and told us we could receive a higher commission rate if we turned our sales directly over to him rather than through you. What else could we do?" Half-heartedly, thanking Don for his honesty, Brian immediately called Morgan, the new president, who worked in an office a few miles away, and demanded an appointment. "Sure," said Morgan, "tomorrow, 10 a.m. When Brian walked into the president's office the next day, he didn't mince words. "Morgan, is it true that you're offering more commission to some of my salespeople if they turn over their sales directly to you?" Morgan's face did not betray any surprise. He chuckled. "Yeah, it's true. Look, Brian, I like you, but you're just out of graduate school, and I really can't afford an inexperienced guy running the marketing and sales side of this business. I've got to keep hold of the reins myself to take this company where I want it to go. But hey, there's a place for you here. I'm glad you dropped by. I've been wanting to talk to you about your future." Brian shot back. "I already know about my future. I quit. Just pay me the $8,500 in commissions you owe me." Morgan's expression finally cracked with a frown. "Hold on, Brian. Most of that money represents commissions on personal sales, and as far as I'm concerned, those sales are house accounts. No vice president of marketing and sales should get commissions for such sales. We only owe you $2,500. Without uttering another word, Brian spun on his heel and left the office. Reaching his car, he yanked open the door, climbed in, and left a smoking strip of rubber as he shot out of the lot. During his one-hour commute home, he replayed in his mind the illusion of good fortune he once held. Imagining himself the victim of a terrible ruse, Brian found a lot of gut-wrenching questions racing through his mind. What am I going to tell Christy? What will my friends from Northwestern think? Worse, what will my brother think? Brian arrived at his brother's house in a black mood. Anger, confusion, and embarrassment boiled up as he felt more and more victimized by Sam, Dave, and Morgan. Fuming, he pounded the steering wheel, muttering, "I'll never trust anyone again." 3 years later, the episode still infuriated him. So, he sighed as he finished recounting the story to Andy Dowling, anybody can get mugged, and I mean really beaten up by the people who are supposed to be looking out for your welfare. I don't know how that guy in the hospital feels about his attacker, but I bet it would be even worse if it had been a friend doing the job on him. Finally, Andy spoke up. Don't take this wrong, Brian, but the way you told your story, it sounds like you had nothing to do with the outcome. Brian frowned. I didn't. But Brian, wasn't there something you could have done to prevent what happened to you? Yeah, I could have gone to work at Citicorp in the first place. Hey, what's this? I thought you'd be on my side. I am. That's why I think we should talk through what happened to you. Andy then tried to help Brian consider what he might have done differently. The two continued their discussion for a week as they commuted to and from work. Uncomfortable at first, Brian actually began looking forward to the talks because they afforded him an opportunity to examine feelings he had not shared with anyone but his wife. Gradually, Brian came to see that he had only been looking at the facts from the victim's point of view, while in fact another viewpoint actually existed. Such a realization represents a crucial step for anyone who wants to move beyond feeling victimized. While a situation may seem starkly black and white from a victim's angle, within the context of accountability, it may take on more shades of gray. For instance, from the standpoint of accountability, Brian could see how he had let himself get sucked in by the promise of a quick road to wealth and prestige. The luxurious cars and houses owned by the two partners lay just around the corner, or so Brian imagined. He had been seduced by the image of himself as a vice president right out of graduate school, with an income higher than almost everyone in his graduating class. From the victim's point of view, Brian had been sandbagged. But from an accountability point of view, perhaps Brian himself had been too greedy, short-sighted, immature, and vain. Together, Brian and Andy reviewed the following questions to help Brian adopt a more accountable attitude. 1. What facts which you knew to exist did you choose not to acknowledge? 2. If you were to face this situation again, what would you do differently? 3. What were the warning signs along the way? 4. What could you have learned from your previous similar experiences that might have helped you avoid or minimize the negative outcome? And 5. Can you see how your behavior and actions prevented you from getting the results you wanted? With Andy's help, Brian tried, sometimes painfully, to answer those questions. Not surprisingly, he began to probe some aspects of himself that he had selectively screened out of his consciousness. One of the facts Brian chose not to acknowledge or remember was a conversation that had taken place the summer before with his boss, Sunshine Pool Products' then Vice President of Marketing and Sales, Bill Wald, prior to Bill's resignation. When Brian had asked Bill why he was working for Sunshine and what he expected to happen down the road, Bill had spoken confidentially of the pact he had made with Sam and Dave to make great things happen in the future. When Brian heard Sam suggest a similar pact almost a year later, he had ignored or suppressed that earlier conversation. This time, the two partners really meant it because, after all, they were talking to Brian Porter, whiz kid extraordinaire. Brian had missed other hints as well. During his second month as vice president of marketing and sales, he got a speeding ticket driving his new Corvette, and when he showed the highway patrolman the car's registration, he discovered that it had been leased on a temporary monthly basis. That clue might have tipped off Brian that his bosses had made something less than a long-term commitment to his career. When Brian received his first paycheck, it turned out to be somewhat less than the agreed-upon salary. Dave assured Brian that the difference would quickly come in the form of commissions on personal sales, so Brian chose to overlook the discrepancy. After all, he should lead the way in sales, setting an example for his team. Why hadn't Brian demanded a written confirmation of his salary and benefits? Friends should trust friends, he had decided. When doing that, Brian set aside the memory of a partnership he had formed while in college with a buddy that had soured when the buddy absconded with $3,000 in profits, saying, "Sue me. We don't have anything in writing." Unfortunately, Brian elected not to apply that lesson to Sam and Dave. Brian came to realize that as soon as he had learned that Sam and Dave had sold Sunshine Pool Products, he should have sat down right then with Morgan to clarify everyone's expectations and commitments. However, because Brian didn't know Morgan well enough to feel comfortable with him, he decided to let the situation slide, hoping that things would iron themselves out naturally over time. Should Brian therefore accept accountability for what eventually happened to him? In many ways, yes. Even though others did take advantage of and mislead him, he learned through objective self-examination that he himself must shoulder some responsibility. After Brian opened up with Andy and pondered Andy's feedback, he finally came to appreciate both points of view, that of the victim and that of the accountable individual. Finally, Brian was ready to own his circumstances and create a better future. In our experience, however, too few people take this step toward greater accountability. Ownership in the face of change. Too many people in today's society have lost the heart to own their circumstances, and that loss of heart has begun eroding the very foundation of organizational performance and competitiveness. A Time magazine article on the contemporary workplace details one particularly alarming aspect of that erosion. This is the new metaphysics of work. Companies are portable. Workers are throwaway. The rise of the knowledge economy means a change in less than 20 years from an overbuilt system of large, slow-moving economic units to an array of small, widely dispersed economic centers, some as small as the individual boss. In the new economy, geography dissolves, the highways are electronic. Even Wall Street no longer has a reason to be on Wall Street. Companies become concepts and, in their dematerialization, become strangely conscienceless, and jobs are almost as susceptible as electrons to vanishing into thin air. The American economy has turned into a bewilderment of good news, horrible news, depending on your point of view. After 2 years of record profits, Bank of America recently announced that thousands of employees would become part-timers with few benefits. Beneath some of the statistics of economic recovery lies stress and pain. A companion article entitled Disposable Workers identifies America's growing reliance on temporary staffers as a trend that's shattering the tradition of employee loyalty and commitment. The corporation that is now the largest private employer in America does not have any smokestacks or conveyor belts or trucks. There is no clanging of metal on metal, no rivets or plastic or steel. In one sense, it does not make anything. But then again, it is in the business of making almost everything. Manpower Incorporated, with 560,000 workers, is the world's largest temporary employment agency. Every morning, its people scatter into the offices and factories of America, seeking a day's work for a day's pay. As behemoth Fortune 500 companies strive to right-size themselves by shrinking their payrolls, Manpower, based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, fills the vacuum, supplying the bodies and brains those companies still need to accomplish their goals. The United States has entered a new era, the freelance economy, where the ranks of part-timers, temps, and independent contractors are expanding while the traditional full-time workforce is shrinking. According to the Time article, their ranks are growing so quickly that they are expected to outnumber permanent full-time workers by the end of this decade. While this trend may benefit the bottom line, it can take its toll not only in terms of alienated relationships among coworkers, but also in terms of pride in product quality and customer satisfaction. Will temps care as much as full-time workers about their long-term consequences of their jobs? Will they be as willing to go beyond their job descriptions in order to get the result? Or will they use their job descriptions as justification for why they failed to get results? Will they feel victimized by an organization that wants to rent their services but requires them to own their jobs? For their own sake, we hope they don't, because no matter how much your work may change over your lifetime, you will never achieve the success and satisfaction you deserve if you reject accountability in favor of victimhood. The Time article continues with Robert Sheehan, former controller of Ameritech and now publisher of children's books, observing, "The days of the mammoth corporations are coming to an end. People are going to have to create their own lives, their own careers, and their own successes. Some people may go kicking and screaming into the new world, but there is only one message there. You're now in business for yourself. In the freelance economy, owning your circumstances, whether for a week temping in an unfamiliar organization, A few years in a career-enhancing position or for a lifetime in your own business will become more and more critical for every worker throughout the world. In a report on Fortune magazine's most admired corporations, reporters highlighted employee involvement, which includes ownership and accountability, as one common thread among the most admired firms. Most admired companies treat their employees exceptionally well, which is a factor in and a result of their success. Robert Haas, CEO of Levi Strauss Associates, thinks employee engagement and satisfaction are fundamental to running a strong business. He says, "You have to create an environment where everyone feels like a representative of the company. Unless you have people who know what you stand for and want to make every transaction the best, you're going to stub your toe." As an example of the sense of ownership felt by Levi Strauss employees, Fortune described what happened at a manufacturing plant where factory workers identified a serious problem and began working with a local business person to recycle some of the millions of pounds of denim scraps Levi took to the landfill every year. The workers approached Levi headquarters with the idea and won approval for the plan. As a result, all Levi Strauss inner office stationery is blue because it contains recycled denim. The manufacturing plant has cut paper costs 18% while taking a little pressure off the local landfill. Now that's ownership. Why so many people fail to own it? People most often fail to own their circumstances because they cannot bring themselves to accept the accountable side of their story. The old cliché, "there are two sides to every story," is generally true. The victim side stresses only one side of the story, the one that suggests you played no role in creating the circumstances. In a difficult situation, it's easy to feel had or let down and to let yourself off the hook. But when you focus on that single perspective, you screen out the other side of the story, the one where certain facts suggest you contributed to creating the circumstances you now face. In our experience, victim stories tend to screen out all evidence of accountability. To establish ownership, you must find the heart to see both sides of the story, linking what you have done or failed to do with your current circumstances. Such a shift in perspective requires that you replace your victim story with an accountable one. However, seeing and owning the accountable side of a story does not mean suppressing or ignoring the victim facts. Rather, it means seeing the whole story, including the part that may not bode well for your ego. The people who consistently achieve results, people like former Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca, quickly acknowledge their mistakes and own the resulting circumstances so they can avoid getting bogged down in the victim cycle and set to work improving things. Here's what Iacocca told Fortune magazine about one of his mistakes. "I've made a lot of them. Let's say moving the Omni Horizon cars to one plant and then to another before discontinuing them at a cost of $100 million was a mistake. Why argue? We made a $100 million mistake." That sort of willingness to own the whole reality and admit mistakes allowed Lee Iacocca to save Chrysler from bankruptcy and make it a viable automobile manufacturer. On a personal level, consider the story of home mortgage service scams reported in the Wall Street Journal. If you get a letter advising you that servicing your mortgage has been taken over by a new company, check it out before you send a check. It may be a scam. That's what homeowners in Texas learned recently after receiving a letter announcing that an outfit calling itself Mortgage Bankers of America had acquired ownership of your previous mortgage company.